Coming to you across the ether at the speed of light, it's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells of Preferred Financial. My friends tell me I have a face for radio. And Carrie Deese, ninja processor fending off those evil underwriters who want to turn your loan down. Join us for the next hour as we take a look at the ins and outs of mortgage financing. I want to do a shout out today to Alice in Liberty, one of our biggest fans. And to Steve here in Greenville. And now we know that there are at least two people up at 7 o'clock on Saturday morning listening to us. So, Steve, Alice, glad you joined us. And the other three people out there, we're glad you're with us, too. Carrie, today we're going to talk about one of the most important aspects of purchasing a home. I guess after credit, which we covered a few weeks ago, this is the most important. And it also is one where there's still a lot of misconceptions about what's actually needed, and that's the subject of down payment. Down payment is probably the biggest barricade other than credit scores to someone actually buying a home. So, Carrie, rumor has it that it takes 20% down to buy a house after the crash. Is that true?
No, not at all. We have some programs that you don't have to put any down payment down.
No down payment?
No down payment.
How in the world? We actually have two of those. One is well-known, VA loans, which are loans for military veterans, have never required any down payment and still do not to this day. Carrie, what's the other one?
USDA requires no down payment.
And USDA is a very specialized program. It's put out by the Department of Agriculture. It was originally designed to encourage home ownership in rural areas. And it's a little bit of a strange bird. We'll have to cover it in full one day. But if you're buying a house that is in a federally designated rural zone, then you can use what is known as the USDA, or many of us used to call it the RDA loan, Rural Development Authority, to purchase a home with no down payment. So those are the two, VA and USDA. But Carrie, if you're not a veteran or you don't want to live out in the country, what are our minimum down payments on some of the other programs now?
Well, we have 3.5% for FHA. There is a conventional program that you can put 3% down. There is a maximum income limit, and you do have to take some home buyer education. And then a standard conventional, the minimum down payment is 5%.
So really, after the crash, none of that ever changed, did it?
Mm-mm, not at all.
It's the same now as it was then, but we still have people that call up and say, well, you know, I've been waiting around for a number of years to accumulate the down payment, and I don't have my 20% together, but I want to see if I can buy a house. And, you know, happily, we get to inform them you don't need anywhere near 20%.
Right.
If you're making less than a 20% down payment, your loan may be subject to PMI, which is private mortgage insurance. That's default insurance. But we'll cover some of that towards the end of the program, how the amount of down payment you make will affect the PMI, or if you need PMI at all, if your credit scores are high enough. But for the time being, you know, we can let all of our listeners rest assured that you can still purchase a home with the same amount of down payment that you could before the crash. And in fact, really the conventional home ready first time home buyer program with the 3% down is a little bit of a new wrinkle. We didn't actually have that before the crash. In regards to down payment, I'm going to take us to our word of the day. Almost forgot the word of the day, and that is verified funds. Now, are verified funds A, the funds you have that your friends liked on Facebook? Is it the funds you have that Google let all those advertisers know about? Is it the funds that you have that Alexa will tell us about if we ask her? Or D, are verified funds the funds you have had in your account for 60 days prior to applying for a mortgage that can be sourced as down payment? The answer at the end of the program.
I'm sure it will come as a big shocker.
It will be a big surprise. I'm going
to
give you a hint. It may not be A and possibly could be B, but we'll let you know at the end of the show. Now, again, having addressed the misconception of the amount of down payment you need, one thing that has not changed at all is the verification of the funds that you are going to use for down payment. Why would the lender be worried about where you got the money that's going to go in as down payment? What do they care?
Surprisingly, where the down payment comes from ultimately affects the default rate on the loans.
That's absolutely right. It's a statistic that has been kept for 70 years by all of the loan institutions, all of the conventional Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA. And where a borrower does not have their own saved and earned funds in a transaction, the default rate can be double of where they do. So it's a very important aspect of the down payment process to source where the down payment came from. Now, does that mean, Carrie, it's got to be from your own saved and earned funds?
Oh, no. There are different sources that are acceptable. It's just very specific.
That's right. For instance, it is possible on all of the programs that we've mentioned for your down payment to come from a gift.
Sure.
However, that loan will be rated as a higher risk loan. So sometimes, for instance, we'll run an FHA automated underwriting on a scenario in which the borrower's down payment is a gift and we get turned down. But when we run that same scenario through and the down payment is coming from the borrower's own saved and earned funds, it'll approve the same borrower for the same loan just according to the difference in where the down payment came from. It's not that you can't use a gift or gifted funds for your down payment, but it could affect your approval. We have the ability to determine that up front before you ever get into your purchasing process. You should call us and let us do a pre-qualification, and in that, we will run you through the automated underwriting systems. They will indicate whether down payment funds need to come from saved and earned funds or whether you can indeed use a gift. And Carrie, how can people contact us for that free pre-qualifying?
You can give us a call Monday through Friday at 864-235-9596. You can also just shoot us an email at themortgagemoment@gmail.com.
Either way, the pre-qualification process takes very little time. It's free, and there's no obligation created by it. So if you're in the market to purchase a home or even refinance a home over the next months and even into the next year, the earlier you let us do this, the better. We can identify any particular weaknesses and address those weaknesses. For instance, if the system says, no, you're going to need your own saved and earned funds, we can talk to you about how you can accumulate those and where they can come from, what's considered saved and earned. Now, Carrie, once you've made your down payment or you have brought your down payment money, I guess that's all you need for a transaction, right? Down payment and you're in.
That is such a common misconception. We hear that all the time. The down payment and closing costs are separate. So just because you have a no down payment loan doesn't mean there won't be closing costs on your loan.
That's correct. For instance, for a VA loan, which is a 100% loan, no down payment at all, the closing costs can run, depending on the dollar value of the house, the dollar amount of the purchase price, the closing costs can run $4,000 or $5,000, even more. So how can a borrower take care of both down payment and closing costs? Can they get all of that from the seller?
The seller can't participate in the down payment. However, you can negotiate the purchase contract so that the seller pays your closing costs.
And when we talk about closing costs, Carrie, there are actually two aspects of that. One is legally defined closing costs, and the other is what are known as prepaids. Now, to most of us, closing costs are closing costs. And what we generally refer to as the closing costs for the loan include those two things. But contractually, prepaid items are initial insurance premium for the homeowner's insurance on the property and the initial deposits going into the escrow account. Is the seller allowed to pay prepaids also as well as closing costs?
Absolutely.
So effectively, if you negotiate contractually for the seller to pay your closing costs and prepaids, all you need to bring to the transaction is the down payment. We'll talk about saved and earned funds and other aspects in regard to down payment when we get back. Join us on the other end of the break. I hope you hit the snooze button and are now awake again. And Alice, if you're out there, thanks for listening. Steve, we hope you're still with us, too, and at least we've got two people listening this morning on an early Saturday morning. We're talking about down payment, and we're going to talk about saved and earned funds, one of the very important processes under which down payment is verified in the mortgage process and why it is important. Carrie, when we talk about saved and earned funds, what is the one thing that we can't really use in coming into down payment for a borrower's use as down payment?
That would be cash. It's not traceable at all.
Yeah, unfortunately, because there are some rules against borrowing your down payment, creating a debt to borrow to have some of your down payment. When cash appears in your bank account, the question is, where did that come from? And there's no real means of proving it. So in general, we can't use cash on hand as down payment, verified down payment funds. Now, there are some exceptions. And again, as we get into this program, more and more I've realized we throw a lot of rules out there, and there are often exceptions to the rules. This is where if you call us, we will help you chart your way through the process, because it can be complex. But for instance, down payment, cash as down payment can be used under certain circumstances. One circumstance is where, as a culture or community, a borrower is from a culture or a community that does not generally retain bank accounts and work out of bank accounts, but actually works on a cash basis. Then we've got some other exceptions under some of the first-time homebuyer programs that actually can allow for cash. So, again, always check with us. We can chart you through that. But in general, we've seen a lot of frustration when we go to verify funds and we find out that a large deposit was made because they had been putting cash in the cookie jar at home and now they're ready to buy a house. We'll tell you how to fix that problem, too. But for the time being, that is not the best way to generate your down payment. You need to have it in your bank account. It needs to be seasoned a little while. When we talk about saved and earned, Carrie, what is considered saved and earned by a mortgage lender? What are they going to look at?
They're going to look to make sure it came from an acceptable source and that it is traceable.
Okay, and how long does it have to be in the borrower's possession in their bank account before it's really considered part of their saved and earned funds?
60 days.
Okay, so when you apply for a mortgage, what it means is that in each case, each program we have, you will be asked to provide the last 60 days bank statements. That can be a checking account, savings account, combination of those two things. It could also be a 401k account if you're going to pull your down payment out of there. But we have to have 60 days worth of account activity. And when we have the final balance in that account or those accounts, we have to go back through those 60 days and trace where all the deposits came from. So let's talk about a couple of things that are legitimate sources for down payment that, if they are where the deposits came from, we're perfectly good and we can count those funds. Carrie, what are some of the acceptable sources of down payment?
Salary and your regular pay.
Always that is acceptable.
Absolutely.
Any paycheck you get, we clearly show where that it came from your employment, and that is saved and earned from the day you have it. There's no seasoning requirement. As long as it's in your account, we trace it from that, it's good.
And on the same note, your commission and bonus is treated the same way.
That's correct. So any additional compensation that you may receive from your employer, bonus, commission checks.
Overtime,
even expense reimbursement checks. Because sometimes we have those situations where salesmen are on the road, they carry their own credit card, and then they bill their company for their expenses afterwards. Again, as long as we can show it came from your employer, then it's saved and earned from the day it hits your account and is countable as down payment. What about things, Carrie, like advances on commissions? Or we've had situations where a person is changing jobs, moving into Greenville,
sure,
and they're given moving allowances. Are those allowable sources of down payment?
Absolutely. We just usually have to get a copy of the check that you deposited, which you can get from your bank, to show where that came from.
And occasionally we need a letter from your employer stating what it was. For instance, Bob was paid $4,000 in moving expenses on this date, and then the check corresponds to that date.
Right.
And then it's considered saved and earned, even if it was a generalized check for moving expenses, it can be used. Commission advances, anything like that, that is traceable to your employer generally can be used. Tax refunds, you know, we're at the time of the year where many people are getting tax refunds. That is an acceptable earned and saved funds.
Sure.
Because it's taxes you overpaid from your earnings last year. So the minute it hits your account, it's there, needs no seasoning. It's counted as part of your down payment. State and federal tax refund money. And again, this is a very common time of the year to do that. So don't forget that that can be part of your down payment.
And in this electronic age, usually those are direct deposited anyway. So we probably, if we see that it's direct deposited, we won't even ask you about it.
That's right. It'll show up as from the Department of Treasury, and we can trace it back to your tax return, show that the refund matches what your tax return said, and then it's legitimate down payment funds. Carrie, there's a little bit of an odd one, and we've had changes on this one over time. But you are allowed to sell an asset in order to use the proceeds from that sale as down payment. So, for instance, you could sell a car and use the proceeds from the sale of a car as your saved and earned funds. But what do we have to do to prove that one?
And this is when I become everyone's favorite person.
I'll let you handle all of that.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
So we have to prove your ownership. We'll have to see the registration, the title. We'll have to see the transfer of the title. We will have to get evidence of the blue book value of the car. We'll have to get the bill of sale that has to be signed by all parties. And we'll have to get a copy of the check that was written from the person who bought your car. So unfortunately, cash wouldn't be acceptable in that circumstance either.
No wonder nobody likes you.
I know it.
Have to do all that stuff. Have to have title, have to show you owned the vehicle. But beyond that, you can't just sell it to your good friend, Bob, and say, hey, Bob, give me 10 grand for this car that's worth 2,000. We actually have to show that the asset had the value that you claimed it to be. Now, this is takes me back into the early 90s, but I had a situation where a guy came to buy a house, and he was selling cows. So we actually had to prove that he owned the cows by showing that he had farming income on his tax return. We had to get an appraisal of cows, which is pretty hard to believe, but that can be had. And then we had to show that he had indeed sold the cows with the bill of sale, and we had to get the check that he was written. But he did use those cows for his down payment. So you can sell an asset, but it is a paperwork nightmare. Please don't sell the asset and then come in about 30 days later and say you did it, and don't keep the evidence that you did it. You need all of those things.
And that means that you can't just have a massive garage sale and rake in, you know, $5,000. I don't know who would make $5,000
right
on a garage sale.
That's correct. And we do have those situations, too. And while those may be legitimate sales of assets, you just can't get a value on everything you sold and trace everything in that manner. So general sales of personal property are probably not the way to go. But if you had a single large item, a car or a cow, certainly you can try that one. All right. There's some other acceptable sources for down payment, Carrie. What might those be?
Withdrawing from your 401k. Or similarly, an IRA.
That's right. 401ks are perhaps a lot easier to arrange for down payment to come from, because many 401k programs, in fact, I would say most, if not all, 401k programs allow for what is known as a hardship withdrawal. And the hardship withdrawal applies to a money taken out of the plan for down payment on a house. Good thing about a hardship withdrawal is, number one, it's not a taxable event. And number two, you don't have to pay it back unless you choose to. Now, virtually all 401k plans allow for the money to be borrowed out of a 401k plan. And that's acceptable also as a source of your down payment, or a partial source of your down payment. If you take it out as a loan, Carrie, do you have to count the loan payment in a borrower's debt ratios?
Surprisingly, you do not.
That's a change. We used to have to, and that was a big pain, because that would sometimes kill the whole deal. Borrow the money from the down payment and from your 401k, and the payment back was too high, and we couldn't make the deal work. But fortunately, they determined that, well, that's your money anyway. You can pay yourself back if you want to, but you don't have to. So no longer do we have to show the loan payment in your debt ratios. Carrie, another common one. We have a lot of young couples who are getting married and they're having a wedding and they receive a lot of wedding gifts, some of which are money.
Well,
can we use wedding gifts as down payment?
If you hated me when you sold a car, get ready. You're going to hate me even more now.
I am so glad you're here because people like me so much. You run all the interference for me. So
if you get married, you've got to show evidence that you got married, your invitations or your marriage license. You got to make a copy of all of the checks that you deposit. You got to show that deposit slip because most of the times you'll deposit them all at once, which is fine. And usually the bank will have a copy of all of those checks at the same time. Problem is, a lot of people give cash. Sometimes there's cash in there. It's really just easier to wait 60 days after you deposit those funds to start the process.
And here's a little advice. What we have to collect from you is 60 days of account activity. And what that basically means is any activity in that account that is 61 days or older, we don't have to know about. We don't have to check on it. We don't have to say where it came from. So if you come to us with 60 days worth of bank statements and your wedding gifts or your car sale or your cow sale were 90 days ago, well, we don't have to trace any of that. So I would just say to our listeners, if you're out there preparing to own a house and you know you're going to get some of your down payment from some strange places, just don't plan to apply for the mortgage on your house until those funds have been seasoned in your accounts for at least 60 days. And then you avoid all of this paperwork nightmare. Now, when we get back, we just thought we were finished with closing costs and we were finished with down payment funds. But there are sometimes other cash items, other asset items that are needed in order to buy a house. Those are known as reserves. Reserves are savings left over after you've paid your closing costs, after you've bought your house, and we'll talk about those when we get back from the break. Wake up, Alice. It's too late on Saturday for you to be sleeping. All right, we're going to talk about the additional funds that you may need to have in your possession beyond your down payment and beyond your closing costs. Now, remember, you can negotiate in your contract for your seller to pay closing costs, but, you know, sometimes they don't always do that. So you may have to plan to have some additional funds. Maybe a seller will pay some of your closing costs and not all. When it comes to funds that we need to show that you own, we include the down payment in those, any closing costs you have to pay, and then a last category of funds, and that is reserves. Reserves are money that is left over in your account after you have sat down at your closing, paid your down payment, paid your share of the closing costs. It's really the money that you have left over. Carrie, why are reserves even important?
You know, it gives the lender and the automated underwriting a much bigger comfort level, and it feels like you're lower risk.
And the reason it's lower risk is this. Things happen to all of us, events that are outside of our control. Sometimes those things can be illnesses. Sometimes they can be the car breaks down. Sometimes your air conditioner can go out. It can be any number of unexpected and unanticipated expenses. If you don't have reserves, then you may not be able to make your house payment that month. So reserves to a lender does show strength in your lending capacity because an emergency, an unanticipated emergency is not going to throw you. You'll still be able to make your house payment. Now, reserves are not required for every borrower or every situation. And in fact, as Carrie's referred to the automated underwriting system, that is a system that assesses the overall risk of a borrower's transaction, and it includes the borrower's credit scores. It includes the borrower's credit depth and history. It includes how much down payment the borrower is making. There are a lot of risk factors, credit scores. And once the automated system has assigned a risk factor, it will tell us if additional reserves are needed. Not all borrowers need them, but then some borrowers do. Carrie, do reserves have to be earned and saved, or can they be gifted also?
Most of the time they need to be earned and saved, but in some circumstances they can be gifted.
And again, without complicating things, the automated underwriting systems that we use will designate whether those can come from a gift or whether they would have to be saved and earned, so we can let you know way ahead of time how much you're going to need and how much of that can come from which source. If we're using retirement assets, Carrie, things like 401ks and IRAs, are we able to use those for reserves?
Absolutely. With that, we do just have to prove that your 401k is available for withdrawal, that you're fully vested, and that it allows for a hardship withdrawal. So if it is only available upon your separation from your employer, we can't use it as reserves.
Okay, so reserves are allowable out of a retirement asset if you have instant access to it.
Sure.
If you can go down to your HR department and say, hey, I need $1,500 because I got to make my house payment this month, then it's allowed as reserves. However, if you cannot take a hardship reserve, and for instance, an IRA doesn't allow for a hardship withdrawal, you're only able to count 70% of the value of the IRA as reserves. And the reason for that is if you withdraw from an IRA before the allowable age, you pay a tax penalty of 30%. And then there's some loan programs, some government-insured programs, that actually only allow us to count 60% of the balance in an IRA. So we just have to keep those things in mind. But most people's reserves are in their retirement accounts, and generally we can use those, but we can only use them at a less percent of what the actual value is there. In regard to down payment, in regard to closing cost expenses, and in regard to reserves, the critical link in all of these is that we have to source and verify all of those funds. So, Carrie, go over again what we have to have and what the process is by which the lender will require us to source and verify those funds.
So we have to have the last 60 days of bank statements. Any deposits, well, I won't say all deposits have to be sourced. So if you're on a conventional loan program, a deposit has to be sourced if it's more than 50% of your monthly income. So that doesn't mean that you can go down to the bank and deposit 10 items just to avoid that. They would add those together. But as long as they're separated, we only care about 50% of your monthly income.
So you're saying that, like, if someone makes $5,000, they could have some aggregate deposits in there totaling up to $2,500 that we wouldn't necessarily have to prove
exactly
where they came from. Okay.
And if we have a government program, they look at it a little bit differently. We have to source anything that's 1% of the purchase price of the loan.
Okay. So, again, all these arcane rules, but if you're buying a home using an FHA loan and you have a $150,000 purchase price, any $1,500 more or aggregate in deposits would have to be
right
sourced and verified. Okay. The important thing is always consult with us up front. You can reach us at 864-235-9596. You can also email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. And we can help you prepare for homeownership, help you prepare ahead of time for your mortgage transaction, really so that you can just avoid the hassle. That's sometimes, I guess, the biggest complaint we get from clients is just they get tired of the process.
Yeah.
And they wonder, why in the world does somebody need to know this? Well, let me tell you, it's the old thing that the innocent pay for the sins of the guilty. The reason you have to jump through all these hoops is just because there has been massive loan fraud over the years, where borrowers in some highly creative ways have found a way to game the system. And the process of having to source all these things, trace all these things, comes from the experience that lenders have had in which loan fraud was perpetrated. The default rate on fraudulent loans just absolutely skyrockets. Usually the loan is set up with the intent of defaulting on it, so someone walks away with a bunch of money. And that's the reason you have to go through the ringer when we're looking at all these funds. We can help you prepare for that. So we also, with our clients, try to run as much interference for them as we can. So we often just ask if you'd like at the front end to give us access and permission to talk with your financial planners, to talk with your bankers. We try to put some of this information together for you so you don't have to go chase it all down yourself. Carrie, let's talk about the circumstances under which your down payment can be borrowed. We've talked about how we could get down payment from the sale of an asset. Under what circumstances can you borrow money and use that money as a down payment?
Could be against an existing property under a mortgage transaction.
Okay, that's the only permissible channel under which your down payment can be borrowed. Under the old terms, this was sometimes called a bridge loan. And it happened occasionally when someone wants to buy a house, but their house, their current home, has not sold. And they want to borrow the equity out of their current home to put towards the new home because they're going to sell their home, their existing home, anyway. And they'll pay that loan back when they sell their existing home. It is permissible for a bridge loan to be used. That is the only thing that it can be borrowed against. That is real property. You cannot borrow your down payment by a car loan, using a car as the security for the loan. You cannot go down to a finance company and get an unsecured loan. You cannot go down to the ATM and take a $500 advance on your credit card. You can't borrow it in any revolving transaction. It can only be borrowed as a mortgage transaction against real property. That's a hard and fast rule, effectively, that cuts across all the programs and is the only circumstance under which down payment can be borrowed. We mentioned that down payment can come as a gift. And as you might have guessed, there's rules. And so your down payment gift rules, first of all, primarily remember this, that anyone who is financially benefiting from the transaction cannot in any way give you the money. That means the seller cannot give you the money for the down payment to buy his home because he's going to benefit from the transaction. He's selling his house. Your realtor, who may be your best friend, cannot lend you the money if they're earning a commission on the transaction. So you cannot participate by giving a buyer some of his down payment or all of it if you are going to financially benefit from the transaction. And, of course, with all rules, there is one exception. What's the exception, Carrie?
It can be gifted from an immediate family member.
That's right. This is called a non-arm's length transaction. When the buyer and the seller are related parties, and guess what? There's a rule for whether they're related or not. And that rule is anyone up to a first cousin. If you are related to the seller actually is allowed to give you as a gift some or all of the equity in the property. We'll talk about non-arm's length transactions when we come back. We have this quite often when a parent wants to transfer a family home to a child. Also comes into play sometimes in estate settlements. So we'll go cover those rules when we get back after the break. Thanks for being back with us for the final segment of our program. We're talking about gifted down payment before we left. I want to go over again some of the rules in regard to when you can be given your down payment. I had mentioned that if you are an interested party, meaning you will financially benefit from the transaction at hand, you're not allowed to give money or give equity to the buyer of the house. We sometimes legitimately have a house also that is being sold for more than it's worth. For instance, you may have a $200,000 contract for the purchase price and the appraisal comes in at $210,000. always, always the borrower will ask us, well, can I just use that for down payment, the $10,000? It's worth $210,000. I'm paying $200,000. I get $10,000. Can I use that as down payment? Carrie, can we use that as down payment?
No. Unfortunately,
no.
That loan to value is going to go off of the lower of the appraised value or the purchase price.
That's right. Sadly, occasionally the other thing happens. We have a $200,000 contract and $190,000 appraisal. The lender is going to base the transaction off the lower of the two, so the $190,000 comes in play there. So even if you're buying a house that has additional equity in it, although that equity is going to belong to you, you cannot use it as part of your down payment. That would effectively be the seller giving you that equity and you turning around using it as down payment. It's just not an allowable transaction. Down payment can be given by the seller if you are related to the seller. This is called a non-arm's length transaction. And there are, guess what, rules that apply to this. The standard gift rules apply in that if your down payment is going to come from a gift of equity, let's say your parents are going to sell you the family home because they want to downsize, move to a townhouse where they don't have as much maintenance. And let's assume that the house is worth $250,000 and they're going to sell it to you for $200,000. They have just gifted you $50,000 equity, and that can be your down payment. You can structure that deal where you don't physically have to bring any money to closing because the entire down payment is going to come from a gift of equity. And that can be done as long as the seller is related to you. I mentioned before the break that relationships are considered to be anyone up to a first cousin, and that relationship has to be proven when you do a non-arm's length transaction. Strangely enough, and I've always found this a little bit perplexing, that where FHA is so much more forgiving of so many things, credit issues, down payment, those types of things, when it comes to a non-arm's length transaction, FHA is really much more restrictive in what they will allow. If we have a conventional transaction, the appraised value establishes the purchase price point, and any amount under that is considered gifted equity that the borrower can use. And if they have applied for a 95% loan, as long as the equity being gifted is 5%, then that's all the down payment they need. FHA is very funky in this regard. Even when you have a non-arm's length transaction in which equity is being transferred, FHA will only finance 85% of the purchase price. So if there's not 15% equity being given, you may still need down payment on an FHA non-arm's length transaction where you're related to the seller. But the exceptions for the gift coming from someone who is materially involved in the transaction, they're laid aside for what we call relative sales, sales from one relative to another. These same rules can apply in estate sales where there is a vested interest in the estate and you are going to buy the house out of the estate. Your portion of that has come to you through the estate can be considered your equity and your down payment in estate transfers. Always, with all situations, the reason we have to trace who your seller is, whether or not you're related to them, all has to do with the overall risk assessment of the loan, where you don't have skin in the game, where you're not putting your actual save and earn funds into the transaction, the default risk is greater, and the lender scrutinizes the loan more in underwriting, and it represents a higher risk to them. And, Carrie, before we leave down payment gift rules, under what other circumstances can a borrower be gifted their down payment? Who can give it to them if the interested parties cannot?
An immediate family member can always gift 100% of the down payment. It just changes the way it's sourced between programs. So on a conventional program, we'd have to have a gift letter that everybody signs, and we'd have to see a copy of the canceled check or a copy of the wire. Can't be cash. We keep coming back to that theme. On an FHA loan, it's a little bit more cumbersome We do have to, in addition to the canceled check or copy of the wire, also see that they had the funds to give in their bank account ahead of time. Now, that seems a little bit redundant because we are going to have the canceled check, but you know, if they have a large deposit of the gift amount in their bank account before they give you the gift, we would have to source that back. So, say mom is withdrawing from her 401k, puts it in her checking, then writes you a check, we would have to source that whole paper trail.
And the purpose, and a lot of our gift givers, our parents, get very upset with us when we ask them to provide a bank statement showing they had the money to give their child. Again, the reason for this is because loan fraud has happened in times past, and sometimes someone acting as a relative has gone out and borrowed money and created a liability for the borrower in borrowing that money. The reason for tracing the giver's funds is to make sure that the giver has not created what's known as a contingent liability. That would be a circumstance under which the borrower, the buyer, owes some money back to the giver of the gift. It has to truly be a gift without expectation of repayment for it to be used as down payment. Again, that gets back to the borrowing rules. You can't borrow your down payment, even if someone else has borrowed it for you and now you owe them. So the innocent pay the price of the guilty, as always. And I'm going to let Carrie handle those so they can get mad at her and be happy with me in the office. All right. So we want to talk about down payment and its effect on another significant loan expense, and that is PMI. PMI is known under a number of different names and monikers, but stands for private mortgage insurance. It is default insurance. Back in the 50s, if you were going to buy a house, the only option you had was to put 20% down. Why 20%? Because if you quit making your payment, a lender foreclosed on your house and sold it under a distress sale, a foreclosure sale, they're only likely to get about 80% of what that house is worth. So in the old days, when you bought a house, you had to have 20% down payment so the lender could cover their risk if you quit making your payment and they foreclosed. In the early 60s, some companies originated that said, hey, we think we can provide an insurance product that would insure the lender in the event of a default if they did not get 100% of their loan repaid. And if we can insure that risk, then a borrower can put less down and we'll just insure the lender against loss. And that was the origin of private mortgage insurance. With PMI, again, there are risk categories, and those risk categories are driven by the same risk categories that loan underwriting is. One of those risk categories is how much down payment are you putting down. So you'll actually find that PMI premiums will vary according to how much you're putting down. If you're only putting 3% down, your PMI can be quite steep. If you're putting 5% down, it's a little bit less. If you're putting 15% down, it's really can be relatively insignificant because the risk on a 82% loan is nothing in the ballpark of what a 97% loan might be to a lender. So your down payment can affect your PMI. And the formula there is the less you're putting down, generally speaking, the higher your PMI premium is going to be. And your PMI premium is what, Carrie? How does it affect your transaction?
The PMI premium is a percentage of your monthly payment that you do pay to the lender each month.
And it's basically you're not getting any insurance benefit yourself from that. The insurance premium that you're paying as part of your monthly payment is insuring the lender against default, but your benefit is you don't have to put 20% down anymore
right,
to do a loan transaction. Carrie, we get this question quite a lot. When you have a loan that starts out with PMI, eventually it gets paid down below 80%. Can you drop your PMI after that?
Sure. it should automatically fall off once you get below 80% from your original appraisal. But if you've had a lot of property appreciation in your area and you think it should fall off now, you can always refinance. And as long as your current loan amount or the new loan amount is 80% or less of the new appraised value, then you can drop your PMI.
So it's possible to get rid of PMI once your equity in the house reaches 80%, either by having paid the loan down or by the value of your house going up. However, unfortunately, the government has an exception to that, and that is that FHA PMI, which used to drop off, no longer does. FHA PMI premiums are now paid for the life of the loan and can only be terminated by refinancing that loan to a conventional loan once you have the 20% equity. So sometimes when we're faced on the front end with a borrower who could go FHA or go conventional, the PMI premium on the conventional loan may be slightly higher than the FHA, but the fact that it can be dropped down the road may give you the incentive to go with the conventional program rather than the FHA.
Now, there are some exceptions to that on FHA. I think if you put extra money down up front, it may be limited. But just call us if you have that situation.
That's correct. And lastly, we'll mention LPMI products. These are a bit of a new wrinkle. We've had them for the last 4 to 5 years. These are circumstances under which the borrower's credit scores are so strong that the lender considers them less of a default risk in the transaction and will grant them a loan in which there is no PMI, even if they're putting less than 20% down. However, it's not a free lunch. The lender is trading off a lack of insurance by giving you a slightly higher rate. Your payment will be lower, but your rate will be a little bit higher. Join us next week. Thank you for being with us today. Hope you've got your cup of coffee ready to start your Saturday morning. Contact us at 864-235-9596. Mark Wells at Preferred Financial, your upstate mortgage broker.